Well, this is a dark day. The FCC has voted down net neutrality. I was hoping to come on to this episode, the next episode, and talk up net neutrality. Now I just feel like a jerk for not doing this more consistently. All is not lost. You can still write and call your congressman. I'm going to be putting links up on the show notes about net neutrality and how you can be active. It will take everybody's voices to ensure that the internet is a democratic space for all. That means everybody, rich or poor, no matter where you're from, as long as you have access to the internet, pipeline should be equal. And now on with episode number 450 of Film Wax Radio. Adam Sharkoff here for Film Wax Radio, episode number 450, and welcome to another episode. This is a great episode. We have old friend, excuse me, my ride is here. Why does it seem like every time I turn on the recorder to do these things, that's just when I'm very, very, thank you, that it seems like that's when the emergency vehicle just decides to show up at the corner. I'm not really sure. But hopefully it isn't coming from me. This episode we have on Film Wax friends Jason Cortland and Julia Halperin, who were on episode number 64, if that's possible. Gosh, it's been almost, oh my God, it's been about 400 episodes, so it's about time they came back on. They were on episode 64 back in September of 2012, so it's been over 5 years. I'm not even sure I believe that could possibly be the case, half a decade, but they came on with their film Now Forager back then. You can check out episode number 64. And they are back on with a new film called Barracuda, and they'll be up first in just a minute, and I'll tell you a little bit more about that in just a minute. And then we have on my friend David Rosfeld. Interesting story. David was supposed to be on about 2 years ago. We did a segment at his apartment in Williamsburg with another filmmaker named Patrick Wang, who's since been on the show. That episode disappeared into the ether. It's happened exactly twice, as far as I can remember, where I recorded a show and then went back to get it, and it's not there, meaning that I either deleted it or something happened to the digital file. I'm going to guess possibly back then it was the former, because these things don't just disappear. So there you go. See how transparent I am? I share all of my good stories and the bad ones too. So good news is David Rosfeld is back on, coming up in the second segment. David has a Kickstarter campaign going on for a short film, and I wanted to lend my hand any way I could, and this was probably the most proactive way to do it. So we'll have on David Rosfeld regarding his new short called Bob and Dale in just a little bit. So first up here is Jason Cortland and Julie Halperin. Again, the film is called Barracuda. A young British woman named Sinaloa comes to Texas to find Merle, her half-sister, by way of their dead country musician father. And it doesn't take long for Sinaloa to charm her way into Merle's life. Her singing awakens something in Merle and erases any lingering doubts about their shared bloodline. But an all-too-familiar chaos comes with it, which soon starts to unravel Merle's stable world, her job, her upcoming marriage, and an already tense relationship with her mother, Patricia. And while the family music legacy brought this stranger to town, darker motives are woven into the songs she sings, showing glimpses of a violent rage that's been building for years. The film is now available on digital platforms. It's on iTunes, it's on Amazon, on Google Play, Vudu, and others. The film stars Alison Tolman, Sophie Reed, Joe Beth Williams, Louis Bordonada, and Larry Jack Dotson. Check it out. We have on right now my friends Julia Halperin and Jason Cortland here on Film Wax Radio.
Hello. Jesus. Are you Mel Klein? And your father was Wayne Klein, the singer.
Yeah, what can I do for you?
I'm your sister. So no one ever told you about me.
So are you a friend of Rose?
No, I'm Mel's sister.
Mama, I'm so sorry. I meant to talk to you before you met her.
Stab her in the heart. kind of phrases a song like her daddy.
You gotta tell her to start wearing pajamas. I don't want her getting back to his mother that I got strange women laying around in their underwear.
Now, when I first got here, I didn't think I was gonna like you, but I gave you a chance. You're the only person left in this world who I share blood with.
What's that for?
I would never hurt you, Mel.
Not Hacksaw Ridge, but...
Yeah.
Or I Love You, Daddy, but... or for that matter, the new Woody Allen project, as they call it. Anyway, we're going to move on to a more positive thread here with Barracuda. How's that?
Yep.
So let's refresh, because people can actually go back and listen to our first conversation, Jason Cortland and Julia Halpern, right, Rebecca? About now Forager, which I you know, I remember, because Jim Brown probably put it in front of me.
Probably, yeah. Yeah, Jim was working with us on distributing that film in 2012, and, you know, was a great partner for getting a film like that out into the world.
Yeah. Who's that charming, charismatic actor in Now Forager? I'm trying to remember.
We've not seen hide nor hair of him since.
Wait, the joke being that, Jason, you wore that co-director and starring cap, right?
Yeah, it was the mushrooms that made me do it.
That's right. What, can people still find that? It's quite like on several platforms or something.
It's just we had a digital deal with a distributor that expired, and we're just putting it back up on Amazon and a couple other places to have it available.
And timing it with Barracuda?
Loosely, mm-hmm. You know, loosely. There are a couple of things that, you know, it's when you're making another film, everything else kind of goes on hold, and so once you get that film out into the channels that it needs to go in, then you can start putting the pieces of your life back together.
Mm-hmm. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Adam.
It's good. I don't want to wait too long to say hello to you. So, I remember meeting you guys and then seeing that and really loving that film. And then when I was hanging out with you guys two springs ago at South by Southwest, two South Bys ago, you guys were, was it, or no, it was three. It was three. It was actually, because that's right, the last one I was going to, but you were right in the thrust of Barracuda. And I remember even when I was there, I think you were in the pre-production, all that requires.
We had a long development phase because the casting in particular was very something that we were not going to compromise on. And we mm-hmm. really took our time to put the team together in terms of the cast that we wanted. And that took some time.
Well, since you brought it up, let's talk about it. There's three women at the core of the film, right? And I had it written down, but I didn't bring it in here with me, the actors. I only know Jo Beth Williams, of course. But mentioned first, it takes place in Austin. And what is the actress's name?
Alison Tolman.
Alison Tolman, who people may recognize from Fargo. I certainly did because I watched that show. And I remember season 3, I think, of Fargo.
Season 1. She's in season 1. She's the lead of season 1 in Fargo.
Then maybe I saw her in something else then.
She's done a lot of comedic roles, and we really, really wanted to use her in this role, which is more dramatic. Mm-hmm. And we just felt like
right. She
is funny. She's hilarious.
She does a lot of serial stuff, among other things.
She's hilarious, but we wanted to... She has a lot of dramatic range that I feel like she doesn't get to do as often. So
yeah.
When we saw her on Fargo and some of her other stuff, we just really... That's who we wanted, and we, you know... sort of were very, you know, excited and you know, just pleased that we could kind of manifest the film with that version of Merle, you know, someone who has this kind of subtle and internal but very genuine and deep emotional range.
Yeah. It seems like... go ahead, Jason.
She's also a native Texan, and I think that was something that for us... was important, because when you audition people who, you know, for a role for a character that is from Texas or lives in Texas, mm-hmm. you know, you get a lot of kind of general Southern accents kind of creeping in there. And we live in a homogenized world where the standard California accent has, you know, for everybody of our generation has really kind of taken over. And, you know, we didn't really want these fake Georgia accents kind of creeping in there as stock Southern characters.
Is Joe Beth also from the South?
Joe Beth's also from Houston.
A name like that, where do you get that name?
Yeah.
You can't get that up in New Jersey, I don't think.
No. I mean, she's spent a lot of time on the East Coast. I think she went to Brown. Yeah. She's... But her dad was an opera singer in Houston.
Is that right?
Yep.
Oh.
And I don't think that Joe Beth had ever played a Texan character, so I think that was an interesting kind of draw for her. She hadn't worked in Texas. She hadn't played a Texan character.
Right.
But that is, so you know, her background.
Yeah,
so,
right. So she and Joe Beth plays Allison character. You said her name was
Merle.
Her mother.
Yes.
And Allison is engaged. They live together in Austin. She and her boyfriend, played by the actor
Luis Bordonata.
That's right. I can't remember how I know him, but I does he do also comedy? And often no. How do I know?
He has a kind of a recurring character on Better Call Saul. He's been He's been in some movies like Trans-Pecos and
I love that movie.
Too. You know, he's you know, very, you know, subtle and internal actor. Yeah. He's got a
workaday guy.
Yeah, he is.
Yeah.
And, you know, we also has Texas roots, so he's something we wanted to bring in.
Great. So one day at their door the all of a sudden a young woman from the UK shows up who has a thick British accent, obviously, and she shows up at the door, and it turns out we can say, right, because this is part of the first minutes of the film, essentially,
she's claiming to be
her sister,
half sister,
right, of course,
by way of a deceased country musician, touring musician
dad. That makes sense. There are probably a lot of cases of this going on, especially back in the day. Anyway, so that's the premise. But why don't you get into a little bit more detail what you can, in terms of the plot, in terms of what you can divulge, and about, you know, the relationship that begins with the two women. And
sure. You know, it's again, you know, we when we started making this story, we were at a artist residency up at Yaddo, which is, you know, where Patricia Highsmith wrote Strangers on a Train. And a lot of people don't know that Patricia Highsmith is a native Texan as well.
I didn't.
From Fort Worth originally.
Uh-huh.
You know, they either locate her in New York or they locate her in Switzerland where she died. But she's a Texan. And we really wanted to work in suspense. Some people are calling this film a thriller, but it's really psychological suspense. That's what it's designed to be.
Yeah.
So it's really about the kind of the psychology between these two characters that form a sort of double, just like, you know,
yes,
the talented Mr. Ripley or Strangers on a Train, which is what, you know, Patricia was great at, is kind of, you know, creating these foils. And so part of it is about the tension of, are they or aren't they really sisters? How much of this story is true? What do you believe? And then you kind of get beyond that into what a real bond between these two characters and what they're getting from each other. And I think that's where a lot of the tension and drama really comes from, is the subtext of what's really happening between these two people and, you know, what we're imagining their family histories really being.
Right.
One of the things that we wanted to really explore with the film is that, you know, we're interested in elevated genre. We're interested in genre films that have kind of a basis in, like, psychological honesty. So the sort of, Let the Right One In, or these kinds of films that use the language of genre but sort of have a more sort of deeply rooted psychological underpinnings. And that's what we wanted to do. So we wanted to look at these family relationships of, you know, well, what happens if you find out you have a secret sibling? What happens if, you know, the family that was already complicated, if you're Merle and this parent that you had that was already a little bit absent turns out to have had another family you never knew about?
Yes.
And we wanted to explore those emotional questions through the language of genre filmmaking.
Yeah, but it comes, the real sense of tension comes whether it from not really the fact that there may be a, that there's a secret sister, but is it really?
Right.
You know, and that, does the secret sister know something that her other supposedly sister doesn't, you know?
Yeah, and I think that that kind of deep family history, I mean, that's the germ. It's, I mean, there's something like that in my family, which is where this kind of whole idea came from. And rather than, you know, kind of actually dig in to find out how much truth there was to it or kind of disrupt some other people's lives, this right. is a much safer fictional way of kind of playing with that.
Reconsidering for a minute doing some sort of documentary?
No, I mean, it would be really painful. It's kind
that's
of
the idea, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's safer for me. I think somebody could make a good film that way. I don't think I could make a good film that way. I think it was better to like tease out this idea in a safe petri dish. I mean, and the other thing that we talk about with this film that is that, you know, these are female characters that we don't usually get to see in female relationships that, you know, they're fairly different women, each of the three main leads. And I think that that's also kind of part of what feeds into the sense of suspense is mm-hmm. that we're really trying to understand how, you know, kind of the forces that shape the lives of these three women. I can't thank our actors enough for kind of taking that on and really building that deep interior world. You know, I think they did a great job, each of them.
Mm-hmm. I agree. It's terrific. The performances are really great. And the Barracuda reference is the father's guitar that
becomes kind of this totem that passes to the British daughter, because the Texas daughter is not a musician. She's completely turned her back on that world. Whereas this British girl has grown up at a distance from all of that culture, and she's imagined kind of America and Texas and kind of the whole world of being a musician, you know, as this very romantic and idealized nostalgic thing. And I think that's also a big part of her psychology of kind of this hyphenation of being a British Texan mm-hmm. in her mind and what that entails.
There's a connection between musically there's music plays a big role here. We have a number of performances and the songs. She sings some of her dad's stuff, and there's a connection between like the British kind of type of
murder ballad. I mean, right. the structure that we really
long black veil type of you know historical.
Yeah, and this is a tradition that started in the British Isles, and then it came over to the American South, and kind of changed into something else while maintaining. You know, the arrangements changed, but the lyrics largely remained intact. Mm-hmm. They might change a few names of places, like the Oxford girl became the Knoxville girl when it came to America, but it's essentially the same story. And it usually just starts with this very kind of, you know, normal domestic setup, you know, two sisters going for a walk, or kind of a boy and a girl going for a walk in the woods. Mm-hmm. And you know, then something very dramatic happens where this mundane situation shifts into something horrific, you know, very suddenly.
Yes, but it's great. So did that add a lot of challenge to making the film, all the music and having to incorporate that, because that requires a lot of care and attention and a different way that, you know, an acting performance might.
Yeah, I think that in a couple different ways. One was that we were very committed to finding an actress who would sing and play guitar herself. Uh-huh. We didn't, you know, certainly the singing, and I just should mention Sophie Reed, who's the actress that we cast as Sinaloa,
yeah.
mm-hmm. the British sister. And Sophie's a very, very talented actress, but she's also an amazing singer.
Mm-hmm.
And her voice is just so expressive and beautiful. And we were sort of pressured by certain people that, like, you know, you could cast someone who's better known and maybe use a hand double for the guitar parts. And we were very, very committed to not wanting to do that, because we wanted the musical performance to be part of the emotional performance. We mm-hmm. didn't want it to be, you know, first of all, I think you can tell if it's faked. And second of all, it just really robs the opportunity for the music to kind of be an extension of what the character is emotionally going through.
Mm-hmm.
So Sophie had some guitar playing experience. She worked really hard with Colin Gilmore, who was also our music consultant, and he's himself is the son of a Texas music legend, Jimmy Dale Gilmore of the Flatlanders.
That's funny.
So he grew up, you know, he's a friend of ours.
He's a local.
And also, he's a local, but he also, you know, has
his daughter.
What's that?
Sorry to interrupt you. I was saying I saw Jimmy Dale, same trip, I think.
Oh, yeah.
When I was with you guys.
Yeah. Jimmy's amazing.
At that bar That place.
Threadgills.
We were together.
Yes. Yeah, so that's Jimmy.
That's Jimmy right. I was there with you guys.
Yeah. It's incredible.
We're sitting together. It's just my synapses are popping. So at that one, I remember hanging out with his daughter. Because right. I had, yeah, and who I'd met at, coincidentally, Lewis Black's house where I interviewed
John
Sales.
Oh, John Sales. Okay.
Wrong Jonathan. So it's a weird kind of little connection, series of connections there. That same trip, that's right, I was, remember, I think you lent me your bike, so I biked over and I interviewed John Sales at Lewis Black's, who's right. the, for people who don't know, the founder of the South by Southwest, and which I didn't realize at the time.
Oh.
But he was having his house renovated, but they had a beautiful downstairs.
In, yes.
Where it was like a studio.
Yes.
A movie theater
yes.
down there.
Yeah, it's incredible.
And John and I talked. You can find that episode. It's episode number 300, I think. And I remember that because it was 300. And yeah, and then I met his daughter, who was happened to be there. Jimmy Dale Gilmore's was there at the house, and then I ran into her again when we went to that. What was the name of that club slash restaurant?
Threadgills, which is like a sort of legend of Austin music. But
sure.
Austin is like that. I mean, it's that story is amazing, but also kind of like, yeah, of course, because those interconnections, and yes, so and so is a musician, and they're also the son or daughter of so and so. You know, there's yeah. they're dynasties, you know, they're dynasties. They're kind of, you know, clans or, yeah. or, you know, tribes. They have these relationship interrelated, you know, collaborative, creative relationships. And it is amazing with Colin and Jimmy Dale, because they'll, you know, when they perform, and maybe it was that performance that you saw with us, it's like, oh yeah, this is when we always play at birthdays, you know, and, mm-hmm. And like in my family, we don't sit down and all, you know, birthday comes along and we don't sit down and play folk songs together.
Yes, yeah.
But that's the way they do it in Texas. And that's what Sinaloa wanted to be part of, is those, she yeah. wanted to join her tribe.
Right. Interesting.
We had, when we actually had our rehearsals with the actors, one of the things that we showed, Allison and Sophie was a scene from Heartworn Highways.
Oh yeah, I love that documentary.
It's a fantastic sure. documentary, yeah. And
it's a classic.
Yeah, and there's a scene there that happens at Guy Clark's house in Nashville, like on Christmas Eve, where everybody it's like a young Steve Earle and, you know, 15 other kind of musicians and they're all just kind of sitting around trading turns, playing songs and smoking and drinking, you know, red wine out of jugs. And it's just, and then in the background, you see these little kids kind of scrambling around in the background. Mm-hmm. And it's like, that's their Christmas Eve. That's how they're spending their holidays, kind of around these adults who are all busy doing their thing and, you know, kind of sharing the music, but also, you know, getting drunk and probably getting high.
Yeah. I was going to mention that part of it too. It's all bound together.
Are there any Christmas presents? Who knows?
Yeah,
it's like that's not the Christmas Eve that I had, but it's like we wanted.
Yeah, and there's no. I can answer you, Julia, who you may not have heard it. She said, Julia said that, and there were no Christmas presents under the tree because they're all just spending all the money on the booze. So yeah, that's why the next generation are so resentful. And,
also,
and they're such no, they love their. There is always that, you know, the next generation of all these icons like Guy Clark or Johnny or Merle, all those guys, you know, they have these, you know, they finally maybe at the very end of their life, they reconcile with their children because their children grew up around their parents being high and drunk and spending Christmas with them. They had their buddies over. Sometimes the kids get a little bit neglected is all I mean to say in that.
But it's both. It's romantic and it's painful. And Merle grew up with that. Merle right. grew up in that world, and she
yes.
had
yes.
the actual experience of it. And Sinaloa yeah. grew up outside of it, so she has the idealization of that experience.
Oh, right. She can't even go through the resentment of it because it was never the guy was never around. The dad really wasn't even around in the first place to be abandoned. You know, although
he was there and then he was gone, but she didn't have the day to day ongoing experience of it that Merle had. And,
right.
and I think
the secret family.
Right. Right. The secret family.
The
exactly.
Secret family. Yeah.
The other thing, just in getting back to your question of like, what were the challenges? We were very committed to the fact that there was live music throughout the film and it would be performed live
yeah.
and we would record it. And that's just what we were going to do. And we didn't listen when people told us that that wasn't going to work. And we didn't listen when people told us it was a bad idea. We just were like, no, 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 no. That's what we're going to do. And And it was challenging. You know, we have one of our early days of shooting was at the Saxon Pub with the Mastersons performing. And the Mastersons are amazing, incredible musicians who are also part of Steve Earle's current lineup, the Dukes and Duchesses.
Oh, wow. Okay.
They're just incredible. And so, you know, we had several dramatic scenes to shoot as well as live music. And, you know, one of our producers was like, oh, this is gonna, I don't know. We're just like, no, we're going to do it.
Uh-huh.
And then at that moment when the Mastersons, it was probably day three of production, and when the Mastersons started playing, kind of the whole crew sort of stopped and looked at each other. And there was this moment where our crew and our producers and our cast finally got it. Mm-hmm. Like this vision that we had of like, no, we are going to record this music and it's going to be part of the film and it's going to be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
It finally happened on set, and it was a really gratifying moment of everyone sort of being like, oh, here's the movie. This is what we're doing. So, you know, sort of creatively and technically, we had to rise to that. We had to find a way to mic, you know, five musicians around a campfire outside at night mm-hmm. playing acoustic guitars. Like, that's hard to mic that well. You know, but our sound recordist, Paul Tui, who's amazing, did a lot of research about like, okay, well, how can I hide lavs in the guitars and how can
yes.
I, you know, like, and so the fire noise or the crowd, you know, the audience noise doesn't take over the singing and guitar playing because it's outside. You don't have a board you can run off of,
right.
You know.
Yeah, no, it seemed very complex. That's what it's
yeah.
So is there going to be a soundtrack?
That's something that we've been working on, and uh-huh. we really want to do that. There's a lot of songs that are only briefly in the film or that ended up getting cut from the film. So we have a fantastic...
Yeah, we have the material. That's not...
We have the material. We've yet to find the right partner to put that out with us.
Uh-huh.
So we've sort of talked about some different ways of doing it. We're really extremely proud of the music, and there is an audience for that music.
I just want to introduce you to one guy.
Oh, great.
Who I used to work with at Sony. He's basically that runs the project, all the project management at Legacy Records.
Oh, great.
So he's became pretty close to Johnny Cash.
He's
a young guy. He's in the Jayhawks.
Oh, wow.
He ended up being in the Jayhawks because he just was a musician. He knew the guy, Jayhawks, and he re-released their stuff.
Oh,
and
great.
So
great.
You should meet him. At least talk to him. I'll connect you.
I mean, yeah, we would love to because we feel like this music is so strong and there's an audience for it, but
finding
the right sort of partner and platform
also,
for how to do
that. Also, I have a guy at The Orchard, too.
Oh, okay. We'll talk about that.
Oh, sure. Okay. Does the film, I mean, speaking of which, and this can be, of course, off the record, but are we distributing? I didn't know exactly what the next step was.
It's had a theatrical run
through
Goldwyn, Films, Samuel Goldwyn.
Right. Okay.
It had a theatrical run. It was a limited theatrical run. And
Obviously in Austin.
It was in Austin and L.A.
Okay.
And Chicago and then some other cities.
Do you have to have it in New York, too?
No.
Yes, we wanted
to have it in New York, but we did not have it.
When was the...
It opened on October 6th, 7th, sorry.
Is it crazy? Why is it that I didn't insist on doing something with you guys? So, I have listeners. And it doesn't, you know, we can always, you can use it to promote. Anyway, it doesn't matter. It's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
It had a
limited theatrical run, and now it's out on you know iTunes and Amazon.
Oh, so it is already okay.
It's out.
That's
yeah.
good. That's great. Okay,
yeah.
Well, at least for our purposes, for this
yeah.
is terrific.
Yeah.
So and when did that happen? Just so I know.
It came out on I think November 7th.
Okay.
I think.
Oh, just the other day. Okay.
Yeah.
So great. So Barracuda, co-directed by the filmmaking team of Julia Halperin and Jason Corlin, is currently available on iTunes and. What other platforms?
Amazon.
Okay.
And Canopy and, you know, all of Google Play,
Google
all those
Play.
Things that I've never used.
Vudu or...
Yeah, it's on Vudu.
Yeah. Let's not short shrift Vudu.
Yeah. Owned by Walmart.
It is. I mean, it is. Okay. Well, great. So that's good. It's a great movie and people should make a double feature then in the... over the Thanksgiving holiday. That means I would be putting this up over the before that, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'm not going to have... we're not going to have Now Forager up by a book because we're getting on a plane to go to Cairo, and I haven't relaunched Now Forager quite yet on Amazon. It's like teetering. I have to push the button.
Oh, okay. So we'll, I can hold off. I think I should hold off, actually, till both movies are available. I don't know. But
sure.
if it's It's close. Yeah, I mean, if it's close. If it weren't, then I wouldn't wait. But if we may as well, because I think the more people that can see that,
yeah,
I think it's great.
To the other show or, like, curious. I mean, I think it's worth waiting, and it's not.
Yeah, since it's imminent, as they say.
We're just waiting for a question to be answered from the Amazon platform people. So
I see. Very good. Well, I have every intention of being in Austin in you know, this coming up. Anyway, it's called Barracuda.
Yeah.
On iTunes right now. You can turn this off finally. Turn off this podcast episode and go directly to iTunes now. And maybe you're already on iTunes listening to this, so yeah. Chances are you might be. So you can just switch over to the movie silo and watch Barracuda.
Thanks, Adam.
Thank you very much.
We're always happy to be here.
Yeah, until next time. Coming up here now, David Rosfeld. He's got a new Kickstarter campaign. The name of the short is Bob and Dale. It's about two older gay men. They're trying to raise money to bring for travel, for the expense of getting all of the crew over to, I think it's Colorado, and then to put them up and to shoot the film. It should only take a short number of days. But anyway, this is looks like a fantastic production. So go to Kickstarter and search Bob and Dale. And help a brother out, after doing my own Kickstarter, I'm far more empathetic of people trying to pull this off. And there's only a few more days of the campaign. I think it ends on the 20th of December. So see if you can help him out. I think he's about halfway to his goal at this stage. Okay, so here it is. Again, this is David. Finally made it on to Film Wax Radio. The problem is that nobody has thick enough wallets these days to get hemorrhoids anymore because their wallets are empty.
That really is a problem. That's a problem. That's the film I should be making.
That's right. Back in the day, you had a nice stuffed wallet a la Costanza, and you just put it in your back pocket. And then, you'd have all sorts of problems.
It was like a phone book because everything was literally in it. It literally was a phone book.
Right.
Because you had all your contacts in there. You had anything you needed.
Uh-huh.
If you didn't have that.
Is that true?
It was for me. Uh-huh. I mean, I just remember like that was when you would go out. And if you didn't have phone numbers or anything like that, you didn't get in contact with people.
That's true. Anyhow, so we were discussing the last time we did this and I had a very unfortunate incident. Which is rare, but that I came up to Williamsburg to your place. We met with Patrick Wang, who...
Yeah, wonderful filmmaker.
Wonderful friend and filmmaker. And I got back home, and I don't know what had happened to that file, but that was very frustrating and embarrassing. And it's happened maybe once or twice.
Mm, yeah.
I mean, one time I know it was file management, where I must have deleted the file before backing it up, and I thought I had brought, that wasn't the case here. There was something else going on, so I don't know. Remember what? Later on, I met with Patrick, but you've been neglected for the last 2 years, or however long it's been.
That's a few years ago. Yeah,
it was right.
And I think it's
two or three, maybe three, because you were about to go to Oklahoma or on this trip.
Yeah,
and
Oklahoma, land of my birth. Mm-hmm. That is where I'm from.
Right.
And, I think I was heading out to actually go back to Colorado for a little while after that, too. I had planned this trip to go out and kind of rejuvenate in the Rocky Mountains.
That's smart.
I was really broke. I was a broke filmmaker in Brooklyn, which is pretty much still the case.
It's also, what's the word? It's redundant.
Redundant,
to
say
broke filmmaker in Brooklyn. It's like all you have to say is filmmaker. Then we already know you're in Brooklyn and you don't have any money.
Yeah.
Or the odds are.
Yeah. So I was in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm.
But you did manage to keep to my campaign, I believe.
Yes, and so, that was great. It was great to see the campaign, and it was great to see Film Mics out there. And I've been enjoying these interviews for years.
I apologize, I interrupted. You were finishing. You were getting a refresher, recharging the old batteries up in the Rockies.
Yeah, I was really burned out. And New York will do that to you sometimes.
Sure.
And I needed some kind of change, a little shock to the system. Mm-hmm. So I remembered this place that I used to go camping when I was a kid, which is a small little town in southern Colorado, Creed, Colorado.
Creed?
Yep. Mm-hmm. Town of 400 people.
Wow.
And about 9,000 feet above sea level. Mm-hmm. And so I was looking, and I couldn't afford to rent a cabin or anything like that. But what I got into, I got this kind of fascination with vintage trailers. So there's these little, like, 14-foot trailers that are called Can-Tam trailers from the 50s and 60s.
Yeah.
And they have birchwood interiors and all this. And they've become popular again, but there are thousands of them around the country that are languishing.
Mm-hmm.
And so I found a used one in Oklahoma City on Craigslist, and I called my mom right away from Brooklyn. I said, can you go over and look at this? And mm-hmm. if so, mm-hmm. you know, grab it. Mm-hmm. And so she did. And I bought this old trailer, and I went and I camped in the National Forest next to a creek for 6 weeks.
6 weeks?
Yeah.
It's like what's the author? What's the guy who wrote about, these guys who go off in the woods and they end up... In those cases, they get usually eaten up by bears and freezing to death and all that, but...
Yes, I would say my 6 weeks was much less plot-driven. than that. So it was exactly the opposite. It was for me, I when I went out, it was like this great romantic journey, and I get this trailer and I drag it up to Colorado, and you're in the process of mm-hmm. of getting there, and it's very exciting. And then right. I got there.
Right.
And then I'm next to a stream in the National Forest.
And what's my own. What day was this?
I actually arrived on July 4th.
Okay, so it is nice and warm.
Nice and warm, very beautiful.
Okay.
Nothing to complain about. I mean, no. If I showed you pictures, it's just it's great.
6 weeks worth of rations? I mean, what do you...
Well, there's a town nearby. Okay. It was remote, but not that... Or I should say it was isolated, but mm-hmm. not that remote.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could get to a town. If I was in a car, you could be in a town in 10 minutes. But it was at the end of this canyon and very solitary.
Right.
And so it was my little kind of Walden adventure.
Well, I was going to say, we're speaking with Henry David Rosfeld.
I suppose we are. So that's kind of how I build it mm-hmm. to myself.
Mm-hmm.
But I got to tell you, it was more like rehab, because it was good that I went, but I didn't realize how detoxing from New York mm-hmm. was going to be such a huge process. And so I was out there. There was all this beauty. I was hiking every day, and that was all wonderful. But at the same time, wow. I just didn't realize, wow, you have been away from this for a long time. You've been disconnected. And it was a painful process, actually, mm-hmm. to get back kind of in touch and relax and be able to sit still, to be alone.
Well, that's what I would be worried about coming back. Like, how do you go back to the city after that? It's like that. So it was like I used to spend my summers up in summer camp, and coming back was always such a... Yeah. jarring transition, but
I guess, you know, I don't know. I'm trying to think of what it felt like to come back. I think that what it is for me is that there are two sides to my psyche. I feel like a very dual person in almost every way. And so
me too.
I love to be in the middle of a world capital. I love New York or London or LA or one of these really big cities, or I love being in a small remote, you know.
Yeah, or completely cut
village,
off. Completely cut off. The other side.
It's everything in between that actually I find the hardest. And I think what had happened was that my city life was completely spoken for
mm-hmm.
and that there was just this empty side of me that needed to balance out. And so I remember returning and I was ready. Mm-hmm. I was ready to come back, and it was much more fruitful when I came back.
Mm-hmm.
But the actual process of rejuvenating and recharging those batteries that had been left underneath the car seat in the hot sun for a long time, those mm-hmm. batteries just didn't really want to do much of anything. So
did you sleep in the trailer every day, and then pretty much, and you could cook in there. And
I could cook in there, but there was no running water, so I only had the creek. And I would go into town once a week and take a real shower, just at like a $5 shower that you could rent at a hotel.
Yeah, you could only pull that off in the summer.
Yeah.
But if anything, were the evenings nice and cool?
Yeah.
Yeah.
The beautiful, like even sometimes freezing. Like you could, you'd get frost in the morning at that altitude.
Right. Oh, 9,000 feet. Oh, my nose. There goes the nosebleed.
Adam, we're just talking about altitude.
I know, but I'm very empathetic. That's quite an adventure. It sounds fantastic in theory. You know what I mean? Like I'd love to do that. But I'm not so much of a loner. I think probably now more than ever I could do it for longer than I could have 10, 20 years ago. I'd also miss the crap out of my kid and things that. But he's getting to the point where he doesn't care. So, you know. But I would love to do something like that. And I would also like to do it with somebody. Like, you know, where... Yeah. We go for an. I'd love to do it with my kid. In fact, I would love to. I don't think he would like it that much. Although he wants to, he went to summer camp for 3 weeks. No screens, nothing like that. And then he wants to go to the winter camp that they're having in February. So he has a little bit of it, I guess, an appreciation for the nature.
Yeah, good to have some connection there.
Well, it's good to see you.
Yeah. So
it's been a long time. Ran into you like once on the street a couple years ago, and that's about it.
Probably
you're not very social. You're not the most, you're not clubby. You're not.
Yeah.
All things I like about you. No, like I maybe run into you at one social event and all the time I've known you.
Yeah. I mean, for better or for worse, that, and that it's interesting in looking at that and being a filmmaker, because so much of film is completely collaborative, which I love. Mm-hmm. And there's a big social dynamic to being a filmmaker.
Like the networking side.
The networking side.
Which is helpful, but also being reclusive is, on some level, also helpful, too, in some ways.
I'm not sure people use mystique in association with me that often, but I'll take it. I think that there's pluses to either way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you can be a total recluse and make movies, and I don't think you can be a total socialite and make movies. You have to have some kind of balance, but you have to be able to do a little bit of both. Certainly if you're like a writer director.
And because you're invariably underpaying, it's a bad term for it, but because the budget is always so low and you're always trying to, a lot of what's accomplished is through doing work for others as well, and doing favors for each other and being available and supporting one another. So, you know, those types of relationships are important to get cheap labor, essentially, which is, you know, nobody thinks on those terms. Well, I mean, of course we do, but we don't think of somebody trying to exploit you. We all know that it's just hard to get money and it's hard to pay people what they deserve. And all that.
Well, in the film community, I mean, everyone I've worked with is very generous. You know, the kind of crew, like the idea, I think, generally is, okay, we worked on a commercial project and now we can do a couple of weeks on an indie because we love the story and this is why we got into filmmaking in the first place. Yeah. And then we'll do that for a couple of weeks and then we'll go back to
And it literally is a couple of weeks at this point. Like, everybody's narrowed it down so much to the point where your film is probably going to take about 2 weeks in production, and then
it's amazing how many films are being made in two weeks. It's right now.
And bigger films too. Now they're becoming. You start seeing. I see all these films, that have distribution and, you know, with sometimes very well known actors in it and all that, and that they've cut it. They've made it in like, we did this in 16 days, and I'm like, that's just nuts. Yeah, I do want to get to. I love just rambling and talking about these things, but I don't want to bury the lead too much because you are in the midst of a Kickstarter.
Yeah.
And we should talk about it kind of when people are still tuned in.
Absolutely. Yeah, guys, don't turn off
the Deep Diggers.
The
will stay with it to the end, but a lot of my audience, let's face it, if they're not getting it, what they want out of the first 10 minutes.
Yeah.
So having just come out of it, we can now talk turkey. I haven't had the chance to really get into it with anybody yet. Now that I've actually experienced doing a Kickstarter for the first time. But is this your first, or is
this is my first Kickstarter.
It is? Okay. Yeah. And how long is it?
It's 30 days.
And you're where?
We're kind of halfway
Tuesday,
right now.
Like the
well, I mean, we have 8 days left. As far as our money goes, we're halfway.
Gotcha. By the way, 20 days or so into Kickstarter is also the halfway point. Because all the action is kind of in the last day or two. So it's like you're almost like, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
I experienced, I think, certain phenomena that was different. I don't know why, but it was strange. But I still did very, very well at the end. But I had a couple of, like they say, the middle period is dead.
Yeah.
I had a real big bump in the middle, too. So,
oh,
but that was just arbitrarily because I just got like Neil LaBute. And I name names in this case because it's just this weird thing. I'm not friends with Neil LaBute. I've met him a couple of times. Mm-hmm. But he kicked in like this enormous amount of money out of nowhere.
Fantastic.
Yeah, right in the middle of the campaign. He just, you know, so that, what was so helpful about that and so helpful about it happening early enough in was that I realized don't be afraid to ask famous filmmakers or people that I don't really know. I felt I shouldn't go to them quite so casually like I went to all my friends and workaday colleagues, that I should treat them a little bit more with kid gloves. And it's not true.
Right.
I mean, you should be polite and courteous and what have you. But I found that I'm doing that anyway with everybody. So be democratic in the sense of approach everybody exactly the same in terms of your ask. And in terms of what they give, accept it democratically, whether they give $1 or $1,000.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter to me. It all adds up.
That's right.
It's all.
I mean, the gratitude's the same.
Yeah.
I think
so
it's also.
That goes without saying.
I think I'm always surprised. I mean, I'm always surprised in life in general whenever you start a project of who gives what.
Yeah. There's nothing.
It's
no
really
rhyme or reason.
Amazing. And always surprising.
Yeah.
We've been really lucky on this project. We had a lot of people get involved that have been really helpful to us. And one of them is Robert Richardson, the cinematographer, has been giving us a lot of technical advice because we're shooting not far away from where they shot Hateful Eight. And so he's been just really generous and a lot of fun. And one of the things
he
told us...
Did he shoot
that one? Yeah.
For
Tarantino.
Tarantino.
Yeah. So one of the things he... said that was not just cinematography related but life related was never prevent anyone from saying yes to you. And it's kind of true. It sounds a little funny when you first hear it, but I was thinking of how many times I've censored the ability for somebody to say yes.
Me too.
Because I made up a decision ahead of time what this person wanted to do or what they would think of me or whatever.
Yeah.
You just have to let go of all of that.
It's right.
And just don't stop anyone from saying yes. And if you get five yeses, then pick one, you know, or do what you have to do. You know,
it's
interesting.
Yeah, no, it's true. It was a series of lessons doing this project.
Yeah.
And stuff I kind of knew intellectually, but did not understand in a more immediate sense. And I wish I had done it a long time ago just because I would have learned some things that are very practical. You know, like the takeaways here are just phenomenal. And so it forces you to wear a business hat.
Right.
Again, stuff you know, but you really got to put it in practice. Like you're asking everybody for help. And then some people that you may be thinking you want to lean on aren't necessarily going to be there to be able to do it at that moment. And they don't have to offer an explanation. And you have to be okay with it and just be like completely forgiving. You just think, oh, well, you know, these are the people I would assume would have been there in a certain way, you know, and they have their own reasons. Just as I have when people approach me, you know. So I just got to get out of my own way completely.
It's so true.
And now that it's over, it's back to where it was before I started. Just, you know, don't have to worry. And nobody need to apologize or explain anything to me or for anything. I just never went through it. So I didn't know. You know, I've never asked for anything before.
Yeah.
I never have. This is the first time I've asked for help.
Huh. Well, that's where you and I are a little different. But
yeah.
In all facets of my life, I've asked for much help.
Well.
No.
Yeah, no, I just never have. I've asked for people. I've asked for loans and I've asked for, I never asked for people just to, based on goodwill.
Yeah, community.
Just to
building that community.
Mm-hmm. And people were just there. So anyway, I just wanted to get that out of the way. Okay, so we're posting this Thursday, which is the 14th of December. Your campaign ends on the 20th.
Yeah.
Okay.
Wednesday.
So folks, you're listening. You have a little less than a week.
Yeah.
Check out the campaign. It's on Kickstarter.
How do people find it? Bob and Dale.
Bob and Dale. Okay.
Yeah, Bob and Dale is the name of our short film.
Okay.
And
what are you trying to raise? How much?
We're trying to raise $23,000.
Okay.
So it's a big ask. And yeah, check us out.
And what are you trying to raise it for? Like production, post production, both? Mm-hmm.
Production mainly. Uh-huh. Our post production costs are really really a great deal. We're getting so much in kind stuff that the generosity from and only we have 20 crew people who are going out to Colorado from New York, and everyone's donating their time.
Okay,
so it's a plane ticket and housing them. Those are the big things: is travel, housing, equipment rental. Mm-hmm. We're shooting for 2 weeks, which is if we're shooting this film in New York, I think we could do it in about 4 days. Mm-hmm. But working at that altitude, and then the two lead characters, one of the characters is 82, the other character is 64. Oh. So we're dealing with elderly actors. We're dealing with a crew that needs more time. And it's just all of it's a big challenge. The payoff is that the locations are just stunningly beautiful.
Right. So
and it's definitely a wintertime film, which is another kind of thing that adds a lot of time to your day. So
sure.
Those are where our expenses come up, is just this thing of making a film on this scale and needing to have in a 2 week period of time, needing to have 11 days of shooting.
Mm-hmm. Great. And so again, Bob and Dale.
Yeah.
Two names. And it's on Kickstarter.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you very much. Take care.
We'll see you later, Adam. Thanks.
No. So I don't know if there's much more. It sounds like is this your first fundraiser like this?
Yeah, I've never done a Kickstarter like this.
Okay.
And it's been really interesting. I think I've always had a little bit of a idea that there's filmmaking and then there's your fundraising. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I've been learning on this is that you really can integrate things. Like, I've learned a lot about our film in doing this Kickstarter. And you were talking about the things you learned about community and people and doing your Kickstarter over the last month. And that's definitely been true for me as well. But I'm also viewing this as a creative process. Mm-hmm. And it's a roller coaster.
Yeah.
It just is up and down, good news, bad news, different things happening. And you're kind of running around doing all of this. But in it, I'm really understanding what the message in the film is in a way that I'm being forced to confront on over and over and over. And I'm a very, when I come up with these things, it's very intuitive. And mm-hmm. you follow a lead and it feels right. And this is this process of taking that and giving it a different type of form and trying to communicate with people in a different way. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I never thought that would be part of the process. I thought it would just be, okay, now we're just going to do some kind of business stuff and yeah, we'll write a synopsis and then, we'll do this. But it's actually been a pretty creative process.
Yeah. No, it's so much to it. You can't underestimate what the, and for my, you'd think I've got a perfect infrastructure for doing a fundraiser because
right.
I've built up this enormous Rolodex full of names and contacts over the years because I've had so many guests on. Mm-hmm. And the nature of what I do is so social, and it's just this constant meeting new people and you're helping them. So it's like you build up so much goodwill with so many hundreds and hundreds of people. And it's not just the podcast, but I also moderate things. I've done things on the TV segments. I've done, written pieces. They're always supporting projects. Mm-hmm. And so it's just built up this tremendous number of people that are rooting for you. I think my number was still a little high. So it wasn't like a cakewalk. It could have been. I think if I'd set my sights lower, more people would have thought, oh, this is definitely something that he can do. I think there were probably some periods where they go, why is he setting it so high and doesn't look like he's going to make it? And if I didn't have a couple of rich relatives and a couple of deep pockets that kicked in and I didn't have, called in some, all those things, it wouldn't have worked, But
right.
but it still was a tremendous amount of work. And you know, what I didn't do and what I realize is the biggest flaw of the whole thing, I have a great contact list, but I could have been even far more organized and ready. So the contact list is the key, and having just so many emails that I didn't do enough of the work to prepare. Like, I could have this incredible list, which I now have, of course.
Right. Hindsight.
But, you know, I still reached, I think I managed to reach like 90% of the people that I,
oh, that's great.
You know, I still managed to read an enormous amount, but I realized all these live screenings I used to do, dozens of them, like a few dozen. But there were so many, again, filmmakers that were never on the podcast, so I didn't take into account a lot of those people. Mm-hmm. So I started catching up late in the campaign of finding those names and emails and blasting out emails to them and all sorts of other folks, going back and finding emails. Fortunately, I hoard emails, and I've organized emails really well over the years in order to find stuff. So I have all this contact information.
Right.
But you need to have, like, export it and make it into, like, a spreadsheet,
right?
And
right.
You need to put in, you need to prioritize the people you know are going to be supporting you, and then those who may be, and then those who probably won't, and prioritize, and just keep, you know, hitting, and then you go onto Facebook, and you just keep trying to hit them up, and in those last hours, maybe you're even calling or texting people, which is a little bit aggressive. I thought, you know, you're putting people really on the spot if they don't want to be involved, and you're. They're not going to appreciate it. You know, you are trying to make a goal. And then a lot of people kept upping their existing gives. It's amazing.
Yeah.
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 Now the next part is just kind of there's a bunch of people that probably had a card on the Kickstarter, I guess, associated in that one. Maybe it's expired, so I got to wait for them to work out there.
Oh, yeah.
Or the little, politely.
Right.
Or whatever, yeah.
Those little snafus.
The tiny. But that's something I didn't know about beforehand. It's a glitch, I think, in the system, although I don't know what the workaround would be, is that people can, if you have a credit card and you only have $20 worth of credit, you can still pledge
whatever you want,
because you don't get charged on Kickstarter.
Right.
You can't do it on Indiegogo, because I think they do charge you, and then it sits in escrow kind of thing, I think, unless I'm mistaken.
See, Indiegogo doesn't have that. All or nothing.
All or nothing, no.
Yeah. Right.
Now, what do you think of that, David? Because I felt that I could have raised the threshold where I wouldn't have had to worry about, like, I could have just completely relied on asking and getting, and wouldn't have acted quite so ambitiously in my asking. So I think having the all or nothing motivates you far more, first of all. Secondly, I think it sends a message of confidence. Don't you think?
I totally agree.
Whereas Indiegogo, you're going into saying, I'll take what I can get.
Yeah, we debated that, I think, going in. We liked the idea of the all or nothing. It's the same reasons you talked about. There's a risk in it. There's a little confidence in that. You know, I think it forces you to make some difficult decisions.
Mm-hmm.
And to say, I think we're learning this, too, about approaching people.
Mm-hmm.
The question that we always go in is, what are we asking for? And it sounds simple, but how many emails do you write where what you're asking for is so you've couched it in all these little terms? And it's like maneuvered around making the ask. And I think it's really the easiest way to connect with people is to know what you'd like to ask them, you know, to be clear.
Mm-hmm.
And there was something about doing a Kickstarter campaign where we had to be completely clear in our intentions. And say, this is what we want to do, and this is how we want to achieve it, and here we go, and this is the time limit, and there's just no
transparency
messing around.
Is good.
I like that.
It's good practice.
There's drama in it, too, which just makes sense for a film campaign.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a beginning, middle, and end, and it's like, and there's the big cliffhanger, and is it going to work out? So
I did something smart, which I didn't intend to, it just was accidental, where at the very beginning, I needed a video, a pitch video. I needed advice from people that had done it and who were going to help me out at the beginning preparing. And I chose people that were not going to, they were going to give me very direct feedback and very direct advice, which is great. So that's something else I would suggest right from the start is to, when you're preparing a crowdsource campaign like this, but just talk to people that are not going to shit you, because you need to hear this straight. And it really helped me clarify, yeah, because I went in with some vague things and they said no.
Yeah.
And then getting criticized for my message, getting really mm-hmm. criticized. They don't give a fuck about this or that. You know,
right.
It's like, yeah, okay. I mean, it doesn't hurt my feelings. It just helped me figure it out.
Yeah.
You can't. So that was very helpful, too. And then the last thing was the Kickstarter people.
Mm-hmm.
Incredibly helpful,
yeah,
supportive.
Yeah, it's a great
and,
team.
And, you know, they. In fact, I'm going back there on Monday to talk to them, kind of do a debrief post-mortem.
Yeah.
And to talk about some other stuff. And it was fantastic. And that's why, because they came out and they were reaching out to me to do stuff and how,
yeah,
to go. It wasn't just me asking them. I worked with three or four of those people there over time.
Yeah, they're really great. A lot of nice people there.
Mm-hmm.
Busy. So I have to give them a shout out today because we're the featured film project of the day. We're at the top of the page. So it's wonderful.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I wonder if that helps. It must in some level.
It gave us a little pump this morning. But I think for me, I think you're still just dealing with what it does is it really helps you talk to people.
Mm-hmm.
It helps you talk to people about,
sure,
hey, this, and it's an event for
and
your
another,
day,
right? It's
like
another,
we can just go, guess what happened to us today,
of,
and it's just a nice conversation point,
right?
So I'm not really sure it's pulling in thousands of people from around the world, but it is definitely pulling us closer to our community.
Like you say, it's another vehicle for, yeah, marketing your and promoting your
and that's
campaign.
That's a thing. I mean, you've known me for a number of years, and we started this conversation. One of the things we talked about was being, you know, the recluse versus the being the social person,
mm-hmm, the butterfly,
of which I'm.
You're a reclusive butterfly.
I'm a reclusive butterfly. Oh. Which is that one of the problems that happens as independent filmmakers, and I see it all over, and it certainly happened to me, was if you do get that low-budget feature financed, and if there's a dentist and an uncle and, mm-hmm, you know, somebody, some coalition of people that will come up with the relatively small amount of money that you can make a feature on now, or at least a short film, that's great. The problem is when you're done, you don't have anybody rooting for you. When you've made that film and you're sending it out to festivals or you're trying to find an audience, you're just still coming out of your bedroom. And what's great about doing a Kickstarter is, mm, as much as the money, it's,
right,
getting out there,
yeah,
and telling your story and connecting with all of these people that you didn't know you were going to connect with.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the people that you want to see your film. And now those are the people that want to see your film. So one of the really nice things, and if anybody's listening to this, has been a part of our campaign, I've gotten so many lovely messages from people saying, I can't wait to see this. I'm really looking forward to, or this aspect of what you talked about is what made me interested in this. And so we're looking at all of that and going, now we know when we go out into the world after we've had our skin in darkened rooms looking at monitors for months,
mm-hmm,
we have people that are rooting for us, and that's a good feeling. And so that, mm-hmm, aspect is, it's nice not to be independent. It's nice to have a community.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I have, at the end of the day, 300 and about 360. I was hoping to get it to 365 because my campaign was also about covering 365 films next year.
Oh, yeah, cool.
I'm totally not doing that. No, I'm kidding around. Chris,
that was
kind of just a gimmick. It's a gimmick. It's just a, you know, like a way of sparking the campaign,
mm-hmm,
which, you know, I kind of already do. I mean, in terms of the, it just means being a little bit more active, like, you know, on social media. But that was it. But it was helpful because it really kind of, like, people are, oh my gosh, and that's incredible that you're going to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, so I have, you know, I have this group now, this 360 people. It would have been nice to bring it up to 365 just for that nice little, I should have worked a little harder and gotten another few people just to give a dollar just so I could bring the number up to 365.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a lot of people on there that I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's terrific. And then there's people that were sharing it. I mean, you know, just on Facebook or Twitter.
Oh, yeah.
Just probably, you know, another couple of hundred people. I don't,
yeah,
know. And I'm a little bit, yeah, it was exhausted this last weekend.
Yep.
I really had a hard time
just
getting out
of
it. I kind of did. I didn't. It's not like you're. It's just so intense, I guess. You know, and you're thinking about it all the time, and you get up first, yep, thing in the morning, bleary eyed, still and groggy, yep, and you're sitting to see if you got any bumps or anything going on. You know, it's, you know what I'm talking about. And so, and then at the end of it, I just, yeah, I kind of crashed. Sunday was like, I just barely, I just stayed in this room and kind of lay in bed a lot of the day. So, but I'm feeling kind of back to normal today.
Good.
Yeah. I was trying to think of this funny thing. Unfortunately, we lost that episode we did with Patrick because...
Oh, that was good.
And it was good. It was a great conversation.
He's such a thoughtful filmmaker.
I think we had a nice time. And but I was just remembering how I could never, because of your feature and how the title is such a conversational title. It's it's just a sentence.
Three people I've never heard of.
Yeah, that I just gave up because I could never,
everybody
get
does.
It right.
It's kind of, I've so many times gone back to change that title and then it just never quite happens. There's some kind of, it's like it's been etched in stone or something and it just won't change. But it's sort of one of those things that, that is it's kind of clunky. But
the title, but that's in a good way. I mean, I think that there's so many titles like that now.
Right.
You were a pioneer.
We were trailblazing.
Yeah. People I never heard of. Yet.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the strange thing in the title, I think, was that most people, when they read it, assume it's three people you've never heard of. Mm-hmm. They just automatically think that. And to say three people I've never heard of is kind of odd, because then it's somebody saying that to you.
Right.
And so who are they talking about? And so it's a, there's just some kind of odd little
you have to kind of
twist there. But yeah.
Did I ever... get a proper
nothing really ever happened with that poor film. I will not lie to you, I still have great faith and hope in that film at some point.
I did I enjoyed it. I think we should you know, one thing maybe FilmWax can do is, you know, VHX it, you know, Vimeo, but in a with a paywall, and just put, let's put it on, let's
see what happens.
Maybe film, if you want, FilmWax could distribute it, and we'll put a paywall on it.
That sounds fun.
Give that an experiment. But I know it is. I know it's cliche to say, but it really needs to be seen on a big screen. But, you know, anyway, well, people see it, I guess.
Well, you know, I someone who came on after the film was made as a consultant, and then he became an associate producer, is Robert Hawk. And he helped us, who I think you've interviewed. In fact, I know you
were in the documentary?
Him. Yeah.
You were, right? You're in Film Hawk.
Yeah.
I think I saw you in that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love Bob.
Bob is amazing, and Bob pretty much saved my life. Like Bob is one of those guys that I don't know how many filmmakers he's done this for, but the list must be in the hundreds, if not thousands, in which he is a part of the filmmaker's life where no one else will have
Well,
you.
He did it with Kevin Smith.
And he's done it with a lot of people who are famous, and I'm just curious of how many people who are not famous have also done that, because for Bob, it's a human thing. It is personal.
Right.
And it's part of his, I dare say use the word, it's part of his ministry. Because, you know, his dad was a Methodist minister.
I do know that. Like he was on, let's cut to the videotape here. Audio tape.
Let's cut to
we talk about it ad nauseum.
Yeah, I just feel like Bob is a very special person. And he...
Hey, Siri. Bob Hawk, FilmWax Radio.
I don't understand.
Fuck off, here, Siri.
Okay. That's not Bob, by the way.
I wanted to impress you. No, but he was on the podcast. Go ahead.
I listened to the podcast, and he told me he was going to be on, and so I was like, I listened to that podcast. Was it this summer? I listened to it this summer, driving in my car. Driving in my mom's car to Colorado from Oklahoma. So mom and I listened to that together.
Oh, you listened to it?
Yeah.
And you know, it's an hour, and it's like an hour and a half, but it's because he stammers. If it were you know, if he didn't, it would have been like a 45-minute conversation. But it would have been a lot faster.
Yeah, he has his own cadence.
He does, but he also stammers.
You bring into... You just kind of come into Bob's world.
I just love him.
And
in a church.
Which is fitting. Yeah.
That's how come we started off talking about his Methodist pastor dad.
Well, the first time I met Bob was in a diner, and I had given him my film, Three People, and he was going to do a festival consultancy on it, and I gave him a couple $100s, and I had no money, and I bought him lunch at this diner on 23rd Street, Malibu Diner. Bob knows all of the diners of New York that are still going
after the hour,
and we sat down for lunch at noon, And we left at 5:30.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just this, you come into his world and you start talking about things.
Right,
and
it was
amazing.
Yeah. You know, what was so amazing is he got very lucky because he just happened to have these exceptional parents who supported him. Mm-hmm. That shouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
He had these religious, you know,
yeah,
Christian,
mm-hmm,
well, Protestant, but, and they supported him like that when he came out, they accepted him and loved him.
Yeah.
He was very lucky. And then, I would have him back on every episode. It doesn't matter. I love the guy. I looked to him as like, you know, when I learned who he was, I was like, that's the way I feel about what I'm doing. The same thing. I feel like a connection with him.
And Bob is an executive producer on the current film I'm doing, so that's great.
Wonderful.
So he's involved in.
Terrific.
Reda came in on the script early on, and Bob is a wonderful person to have.
Yeah.
Critique your work, and he goes through it. I remember long ago, I mean, this is maybe 5 years ago, he read a script I had written, and one of the questions he asked me, this was a feature-length script, one of the questions he asked me was that on page 32, Heineken was spelled H-E-I, and then on page 56, it was H-I-E. And his question was, is that a typo, or did you mean to have the bartender, who was in a rural bar, mispronounce Heineken in the different times he said it?
That's overthinking.
But Bob pays attention to your work on that level, and it's really exciting to have somebody read your work who is imagining and looking at your intentionality, so like at that place. Yeah, and sometimes it can be, you might feel like it's a little pedantic, but like he's one in a million like that, and I don't know how he does it as often as he does. So there you go. We love you, Bob Hawke.
We do, and hopefully he's listening.
Yeah.
Well, again, go to Kickstarter, look at Bob and Dale. It's a short film by David Rosfeld, and check out, I don't know, you have some shorts out there in the world?
What do you have? We do. My Vimeo page has some work I've been making over the last few years.
Very good.
And, yeah.
Great.
Check it out.
Well, it's great. And when maybe we'll have you on the other end when the film is made.
Yeah, that would be great.
We can do
it. Yeah, that'd be fun.
Mm-hmm. Do another one of these. I think you deserve that for all the that lost episode. Anyway, great to see you.
Thanks, Adam. Take care.
You too. Okay, thanks everybody. Just Google net neutrality. You'll find a place to write to your congressman, to call your congressman, to sign petitions. We're all a little bit behind here, but we can still save net neutrality if we really make a commitment to doing so. I'm going to remind everybody, please go to Facebook and search Film Wax Radio. Please follow, like us there. Same with Twitter, Instagram, YouTube. And go to iTunes, subscribe if you haven't subscribed, leave a rating and a review of the film. If you're hearing this, you can take a minute and just please go to iTunes to Film Wax Radio, leave us a review. Thank you very much for that. Okay, everybody? So that's that. Next week we'll be back with a couple of another episodes. We have a lot of stuff in the pipeline, so I'm doubling up on episodes lately, as you can tell. Much more to come. So thank you very much for tuning in. My name is Adam Shartoff. The name of the show is Film Wax Radio. Please take care of yourselves and the ones you love.